Welcome back to another episode of The Founder. Each week, I sit down with a world-class entrepreneur to get a behind-the-scenes look into the creation of their company. If you're new here, each episode we cover the origin story, the journey to build and scale, and founder tips and lessons learned along the way. At the end of the show, each founder presents one to two other ideas they're excited about, and we brainstorm on how to best bring them to market. I'm your host, Callaway. Today, we sit down with the co-founder and CEO of Morning Brew, a media company with over 3 million subscribers across their daily business newsletter, functional-specific newsletters, business casual podcast, and more. We cover a bunch of topics, including the unfiltered origin story of Morning Brew and how it all started at University of Michigan, the different growth strategies Morning Brew used to scale from 40 to 2.7 million subscribers on their daily newsletter, designing effective ambassador and referral programs, biggest mistakes when hiring, and how to assess great talent in junior and senior roles, the ins and outs of selling to Business Insider for a reported $75 million, the playbook for starting from scratch today, building an audience and a media brand, and much more. The brainstorm for this episode focused on two ideas, a mental health Sherpa that helps guide your emotional well-being, and a refreshed take on business education. So if you're interested in those, stick around for the end. I had a blast recording this one, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Now introducing the co-founder of Morning Brew, Alex Lieberman. Let's get it. All right, guys, I've got Alex Lieberman, the co-founder and CEO of Morning Brew here. Alex, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming on. It's a long time coming. I'm super excited. So I know you do a ton of podcasts, obviously, with Morning Brew, and you go on a bunch. And so, you know, I think you've done one of the better jobs at publicizing your process and different aspects of building the business. And so hopefully we'll dive into a couple things kind of behind the curtains, less covered topics if we can.
Yeah.
But I think the most important thing and people's favorite is always the origin story. So let's start there just to tee it up. I think, you know, so setting the stage, you're at University of Michigan, you're in business, you've got a job senior year. Take us through like from there, you know, in a nutshell, what's the origin story and how did all this get started?
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, as you said, went to Michigan, was always going to do the finance thing. You know, my dream job was being the world's greatest trader. Like that was literally what I had written on my whiteboard growing up in the suburbs of New Jersey. I grew up in a finance family. You know, my dad worked in sales and trading for Citigroup. My mom worked in sales and trading for Nomura, a Japanese bank. And my grandpa worked in sales and trading at Prudential. All of this to say that I really only had one possible path because someone who like values family more than anything, and I saw every single family member doing the same thing, like that was it for me. I was like, I want to be like my mom, like my dad, like my grandpa, so I'm going to be a great trader. And so that was one of the reasons I went to Michigan, one of the reasons I was in the business school. And, you know, I was in my senior year at Michigan. I already had my job offer in hand to work at Morgan Stanley in sales and trading. And so, you know, for all intents and purposes, like I'd peaked at that point. Like I got my job to work at Morgan Stanley. I had all this free time. And I was just trying to find ways to pass the time because I didn't have to re-recruit my senior year. I only had to take two or three classes because of just the way the credits worked out. And I just had all this free time and I was like, I need to do something to pass the time or I'm not going to be sharp enough when I start my job after college. And so I started helping students prepare for their job interviews because a lot of people did have to recruit for jobs during senior year of college. And the first thing I would always do is I would mock interview students and I would ask them the question, how do you keep up with the business world? Every single student would have the same kind of canned answer, which was, you know, I read the Wall Street Journal. And I would say, you know, why do you read the Wall Street Journal? And they would say, well, because it's a prerequisite to say you're well-read in business. And that's what my parents told me to do. And the more that I dug into it, the more I realized that people read the journal because they had to, not because they wanted to. And to me, it was crazy that like all these kids wanted to spend literally the next 40 years in business, half of their waking hours, and they didn't have content that like lit up their eyes, that got them super excited to do the work they were doing. So I started writing a daily business roundup, which originally was called Market Corner, was later rebranded as Morning Brew. Austin Reef came on as my co-founder as the transition from Market Corner to Morning Brew was happening. And then fast forward, I graduated from Michigan. Our audience wasn't large enough yet where I was going to go to my mom and tell her that, hey, guess what? That dream job that I've wanted for my whole life, I'm not going to take it because I'm going to go do this newsletter thing that we're not making money on yet. I didn't do that. And so I went, worked at Morgan Stanley for a year and a half, quit my job in September of 2016, right after Labor Day in 2016. Austin joined me full time in May of 2017, which is when he graduated because he was 2 years younger. And so we hit the ground running full time on Morning Brew between, you know, the back half of 2016 and the first half of 2017.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's an amazing story. For those who don't know, and we'll fast forward to the end, but then I want to break it down into different topics. You know, today you guys have over 3 million subscribers across all these different products. You have several newsletters, several podcasts, and it's really amazing what you've done in this kind of business education space. And so, you know, as we go through topic by topic, I'll kind of frame it up and then I'd love to just get your raw insights on some things. So the first one is growth. And so you've got this podcast that you do, The Founder's Journal, which is basically like your kind of personal diary, which I love. And one of the episodes on there that's my favorite is around growth. And you kind of broke down the growth playbook at different stages. And so you went through, and I'd love for you to kind of go through each one, but just to tee it up, there was kind of this hub and spoke kind of grassroots model when you were at Michigan. Then you had the referral program, or then you had the ambassador program, then you had the referral program and some others. Do you want to just talk through, like, you know, chronicling in stages? Why do you think about deploying these different tactics and kind of what were the pros and cons of what worked with each one?
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that I would say is I think growth is really interesting and exciting to me because I think it is this perfect marriage of creativity with linear thinking. And what I mean by that is we didn't raise a lot of money for the business. And in the early days, we didn't have any money at all, right? And so we had to be very practical about how we thought about growing the thing. We basically had to say to ourselves, okay, we have, let's just say hypothetically, 1,000 subscribers now. The question was, how are we going to get to 2,000 subscribers? And we basically, I remember, created a list of what are all of the things that we could do that don't take any money to get from 1,000 to 2,000 subscribers. To me, like, that was the linear part of the process, was literally just reverse engineering. If we want to grow by 100% or 1,000 people, what are all the things we can do? What are the steps to get there? But then I would say that the more creative aspects were some of the things on the list, some of the things that we were thinking about to be able to grow the audience were things that were just like pretty out there that we hadn't heard done before. What we ended up finding in the early days of the business was the best model for thinking about growing the audience was, as you alluded to, this hub and spoke model. And honestly, like, I'm looking for a better name for it. So if you have a better name, let me know. But basically the idea is this, it's like, you have a target audience whenever you're growing a product, right? So for Morning Brew, the target audience at the time was the college student who's interested in business. Now it's broadened out to be the modern business leader, someone who's a little bit older than just a college student who is working in business or adjacent to business. And so what we asked ourselves was, for the college student who's interested in business, what are the hubs that are attached to a concentration of spokes, the spokes being like the actual end consumer? So basically, what are the hubs? What are the things we can get in front of that if we get the attention of them, they can be the best megaphone to getting a large group of our end reader? And so when we thought about that, the example that we started with was classes in college or clubs in college, right? Quite literally, like, the hub is the professor, or the hub is like the club president, where if you can get their attention and you can convince them to let you talk to their spokes, their students, their club members, you have the opportunity to convert not just one, but many people to your product at once. And so that's what we focused on at first, was like, professors and club presidents were our hubs in the early days. Austin and I literally went, we just hustled to get into every business class or business adjacent class like econ, stats, poli sci, and convinced professors to let us give our little spiel for 2 minutes at the beginning of every class. We did the same thing for clubs. And literally all we did is we gave the brew pitch. We story told the brew. We said, if you want to sign up, we're going to pass around a sheet of paper. You're going to write down your email address with pen and paper. We're going to add your email address and you'll get the newsletter the next day. And if you don't get it, and if you don't like it, you can always choose to unsubscribe. And we almost, the goal of the pitch was like, remove any possible downside or risk of subscribing where people feel candidly like idiots for not subscribing since there's no downside. And that's what we did. We just did that over and over and over. And we ended up having people use a sheet of paper and a pen to write it down because we found that that was far more successful than telling people to take out their laptops and type in morningbrew.com and then put in their email address. It adds steps to the process and that friction would decrease the conversion rate of percentage of people in the class that would actually sign up. And so we did that for a long time. And then, you know, the next step of the growth process was to ask ourselves, okay, we've done this, you know, in 20 classes at Michigan and 20 clubs at Michigan, how do we grow beyond that? And so that was kind of like literally like the first growth strategy when we launched Morning Brew.
Yeah, that's awesome. So I would think of it as like, I like hub and spoke. I think of it as like a train the trainer or like a sell the seller model. So like you yep. get those advocates or those influencers essentially. I love that though. Yeah. And so you went from that and then you did this ambassador program, which I have to commend you guys because it seems like looking back, everybody, a lot of people have done ambassador, a lot of people have done referral, but you guys were one of the first to do both of those things, I feel like, especially in media. And so do you want to talk about just like how you set those up and what worked, what didn't with each of those?
Yeah, for sure. It's really interesting because to your point, even to this day, I haven't seen that many media brands that have actually done a college ambassador program, right? Like I've never seen a college ambassador for the New York Times. I've never seen like a referrer for the Washington Post. Not to say those aren't great publications, but it's just interesting to your point. Like when I think of, you know, what are the biggest ambassador programs in the world? It's like what comes to mind first for me is like Red Bull or like the app, the whatever the new social media app on campus is. And so for us, I mean, that I think that speaks to one of the advantages that we had in the early days is that Austin and I were first-time entrepreneurs. And so we didn't have these preconceived notions around like how we should grow. It was more that we had no resources. We have to grow. How can we do it? And whatever's most effective, let's just keep doing that. And so we basically said to ourselves, okay, we did this thing at Michigan with pitching classes on our own. It was really effective. How do we do that at other schools? And right, like when we said that, we weren't thinking to ourselves, oh, you know, media companies haven't done this before, let's not do it. We simply said to ourselves, this worked at Michigan, why wouldn't we do it elsewhere? So then we expanded out to like the Big Ten, right? So we got ambassadors from Indiana, Wisconsin, Maryland, et cetera. And basically we found the Austin and the Alex at those schools, had them literally do the same exact thing. And we rewarded them with like swag and like accolades and like recommendations on LinkedIn, like the things that we thought would motivate them. And that we to this day still do the ambassador program. I would say not that it's lost its importance over time, but it's tough to have it mean as much as you reach a certain scale with Morning Brew at, you know, on the main newsletter, 2.7 million subscribers now. Getting 20,000 subscribers from college campuses is great, but obviously as a proportion, it means less than it did when we had 20,000 subscribers total. And so we had the ambassador program for a while. It was a huge growth driver in the early days of the business. And then we had that next iteration, right? Which was like, at first it was, how do we scale Austin and Alex? And then it was, how do we scale beyond just colleges? Because we have readers outside of colleges that also really care about the brew, that also feel affinity for it. How do we scale to them? And that's when we introduced the referral program, which again, like we didn't come up with the referral program. The referral program already existed. I would say, if anything, we came up with it for doing it in a media context because we hadn't seen a lot of media companies do that. But literally, you know, the idea of referring or being an affiliate has existed for so long. Like, I think about every time that I go to Uber, it's like the, you know, refer someone, get $5, or they get $5, you get $5. And so for us, all we did was we saw that Harry's Razors had a ton of success with their referral program when they launched their business. If you go on like Tim Ferriss's blog, there's a whole write-up about before Harry's Razors launched, they had their landing page. You put your email address in, and if you refer other people to put their email addresses in as well, you can earn more rewards like free razors, free shaving cream, etc. And they collected 100,000 emails through doing that. That was exciting to us. And so then what we ended up doing was we literally went on Upwork and we found an engineer in Ohio who coincidentally had been asked by four other businesses to just copy the Harry's Razors landing page tech. And so he had already done it. He charged us $500. It probably took him like an hour to do it since he had already built the code for it. And that was like the origin of our referral program, was literally just taking the foundation of what Harry's Razors did, but applying it into the context of Morning Brew, which meant instead of they have a woolly mammoth on their page, we had our background. And instead of razors and shaving cream, we had our rewards that would incentivize our readers.
Yeah, I love it. So it's so grassroots. I think, so what you were hitting at and that I was talking about is you were the first to do it in like a media way. And I think to your point, there's been a lot of unique referral programs, and it seems like the first time a company does it in a space a certain way, that's when it's super effective. They squeeze most of the juice out of the lemon and then people just try to clone it. You guys seemed like one of the first people to do it in media, which was cool. And the question I had though is, so a lot of one of your early rewards, I think is really smart, was like access to more content, which was zero marginal cost for you. That's key. But then a lot of your other rewards definitely weren't free, like the crew neck and the mug and stuff. And so were you revenue producing, or had you raised at that point to cover that? Or like how, because you can imagine someone in the early days, how would they offer that referral piece without kind of a revenue producing asset?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I'm trying to remember the exact sequencing of it. My guess is when we first launched the referral program, we probably weren't doing the crew neck at that period of time because crew necks are generally one of the more expensive referral rewards we have. Mugs are actually super cheap. I think we pay 20 cents a mug or something because ceramic is really cheap. Stickers are really cheap. I think stickers like 15 cents a sticker. Before we had raised money, so before we started making money, we raised a little money. We raised $750,000 from family and friends. Before that, we were either funding the business out of our pockets, or what we, again, just like being scrappy and having resources in college, Austin and I applied to like every grant program and every entrepreneurship competition at Michigan. So in total, we probably got like, if I had to guess, somewhere between $25,000 and $40,000 in grant money and competition money. My guess is we had launched the referral program before raising money. And some of that was supported by the grant money that we had won from Michigan. And then once we raised money for the brew, which was in early 2017, that was what allowed us to start hiring people to make better content, to grow the audience in a more scalable way, and to hire salespeople to ultimately start selling the brew. And that's what created that virtuous cycle of, we can sell the brew to advertisers because they want to get in front of modern business leaders. That allowed us to start getting the revenue flywheel going by having more money. That allowed us to then hire more people or spend money on paid marketing. And that's what started getting the flywheel going in our business.
Yeah, then you were cooking. I mean, 40,000, you could buy a lot of mugs with that. You guys probably were thinking like, oh, if someone refers 50 people for the crew neck, like we'll just put it on there. If they get to 50, like then something's going right. So we'll figure out how to cover it or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think that we probably generally weren't thinking about it smart enough in the early days of like, if we buy these rewards, is that actually going to be like a money-making endeavor for us when we ultimately monetize the business? I think we're more just thinking about all that matters is getting quality people onto the list. Like, I don't think we thought about it in a really sophisticated way at the time of like, what is the LTV of our audience? What is the CAC of our audience? What is the ratio of CAC and LTV to our audience? I think we were just like, we just want to keep growing this thing. And we're going to try to do it as low cost as possible, if not no cost. But yeah, I think we were just really scrappy in the early days. And my guess is also we did a lot of things that weren't swag related in the early days. Like, as I think back to it, a big thing that we did, especially for ambassadors, were things like help doing resume reviews and doing like mock interviews and actually making it like career development related, where if you get a certain number of referrals, we help you in like your career search. And like, I can't tell you, hundreds of people on their LinkedIn profiles have recommendations from me saying how they were great ambassadors, because that was one of the rewards, was like kind of this canned answer for recommending someone because they were a great ambassador in our program.
I love that. I love that so much. That's hilarious. When you think back, was there a moment where you and Austin were like, all right, we've got something here? Like, obviously you believed in it the whole time, but was there a moment that pops out to you?
Austin and I, when we made the decision to go full-time on this, you know, I vividly remember it was, I want to say Pete's Tavern is the name of the place. It was on Irving Place in the Union Square area of Manhattan. It was at this bar, Pete's Tavern. Austin had flown in from Ann Arbor for the weekend. And we were getting beers at Pete's Tavern, and then we made the final decision that we were going to go full-time on this thing. At the time, we had 70,000 subscribers. We hadn't monetized yet. We didn't think it was going to be a massive business yet, but we thought, we knew that we felt passionate about taking the risk on it. So we didn't know it was going to be huge then. We raised money for the business. We still didn't know it was going to be huge then. We just needed money to fund it. And we, you know, we kind of like talked a big game to sell our family and friends on the vision of the business. And they were very much investing in us that as much as they were investing in the business. I think a lot of them weren't necessarily expecting a return on a business newsletter. They were just looking at it as a way to support friends and to feel nostalgic, like back into the early days of building a business. The first time that I felt like it was going to be big was the first time I saw a stranger reading the newsletter serendipitously when I was on the subway going somewhere in the city. I don't know where I was going at the time. And it was a packed subway. Someone was sitting on like one of the subway benches, and I was standing up holding onto the subway pole, and I looked down and the person was scrolling from top to bottom on the Brew. And that was the first time that I had experienced someone outside of like a first or second degree connection reading the Brew. And I'd become so accustomed to seeing, like, if I was seeing people scroll on their phones. And by the way, I'd been looking for this for a while. Like, I'd been looking, waiting for the day when this would happen. And normally what I would see is either someone scrolling through Spotify, scrolling through text messages, playing Candy Crush or something. If it was a newsletter, it was someone scrolling through the Skim. And so for the first time seeing someone scroll through the Brew, like, that to me, the fact that I still remember that moment tells me that it clearly created some sort of emotional reaction that has cemented itself in my brain, which clearly meant that emotionally I felt like this was going to be something bigger than what we had imagined initially.
Yeah. I mean, you always remember that. That's like a music artist, like hearing their song played for the first time, like in a bar or something. Yeah. That's awesome. So take the flip side. I think a lot of people, when they listen to this show, sadly, for one reason or another, the thing they like hearing most other than the origin story is like what didn't work and like what were, if you pull back the curtain, what are the biggest challenges? So when you think about the journey, I'm sure there's a ton of like little things, but what are some things where, you know, you either felt like you should have done a better job or done differently, or you guys made bets that just didn't pan out for whatever reason?
Yeah. So what I would say is I don't think we made a ton of bets from a product perspective that didn't work out, because if you think about our business, we were so focused on doing one thing for like 4 years, our daily newsletter, that it's almost like we didn't take all of these other bets to possibly fail. And one could argue that like that is a failure in itself, was us not taking enough bets. But I think our perspective was, let's just do one thing really well. Let's build up an audience, and that will create immense leverage to do other things. when I think about the biggest challenges with the business, I think about personnel challenges. So I think about when people ended up leaving the business or we ended up having to let people go. What was it that led to those things happening? I think in some cases, it was ineffective hiring by Austin and myself that comes from just inexperienced management. People leaving the business, sometimes that's a really healthy thing. I think in other cases, it's been a function of either not supporting people in the right way or not managing people the right way. So maybe it's just because my orientation is always to people, and the thing that creates the biggest like anxiety for me in the business and emotional reaction is making sure our people are happy. But I think the biggest challenges we've had is when we mishire, and generally we mishire either when we rush a hiring process because we just feel like we need to get that role hired, and that leads us to make quick decisions that aren't necessarily the right decisions. We mishire when we take a bunch of individual tasks or activities that have kind of always been on the back burner that we say should get done. We bundle them into one thing and say, this is a role. Then we hire that person. We realize that there was a reason those tasks weren't getting done, and them being combined doesn't make them any more important. And so now we just have someone doing a bunch of things that aren't mission critical to the business. And then I think the other time we've mishired is when, because Austin and I weren't seasoned entrepreneurs, it was our first business, where we didn't actually have the foresight to see what the business would look like a year down the road or 2 years down the road. So we end up hiring someone that's potentially too junior, that is a really good fit now, but will end up not being the right fit a year down the road. So when I think about challenges in the business, it really is all hiring and management related, because I think that is the hardest learning curve for first-time entrepreneurs to experience.
Yeah. Those are phenomenal insights. And I have a question here I want to jump to around hiring. I ask this to every single guest because I think, and it sounds like you do too, people and hiring is the most important thing you do for the business. Like if you hire superstars, you go in one direction. And if you hire, you know, C or B players, the company doesn't reach its full potential almost always. And so you touch on a few key things there. One question that I would add on or ask you is, what's the process that you use to suss out the authentic qualities you're looking for versus, you know, someone either putting on a show, but, you know, telling you what you want to be told? Because I think that's kind of the crux of how you hire well, is trying to get to those core beliefs.
Yeah. So I think it really depends on a few things. One, it depends on, is the role you're hiring for a hard skill or a soft skill, right? The things that I'm looking for in a developer are very different than the things I'm looking for in a junior salesperson. The second is the distinction of what I'm looking for in senior people versus junior people. So for example, for senior people, we've learned this kind of the hard way, but the most important thing with hiring senior people, I think, is one, have they been there and done that? The more senior, the higher, the more leverage and importance they have in the company. Said differently, the more they can take down an entire part of your business. And so I think whereas with junior people, you're willing to take risks if someone doesn't have a very similar experience. At least I think Austin and I are inexperienced enough in our hiring where we don't necessarily feel comfortable taking those risks yet on senior people and then just watching how it plays out. So I think for senior people, it's having the right and relevant experience. The other big thing with a senior person is, I use this analogy, I actually talked about it on Founders Journal in today's episode, which is like businesses as essays. And there are three roles in the creation of an essay. There's the writer, the editor, and the prompt creator, right? A junior person is generally the writer. A senior person is generally the editor and can be the prompt creator. And what that means in my mind is when you hire a senior person, it needs to be someone who understands how to take where you want the business to go and can set a very clear plan of how they are going to get there. And then what is the hiring plan that's one layer down from that will allow their org to execute on the plan that they've laid out. If you don't get a senior hire in their hiring process, by the end of their hiring process, to give you a good indication that they can lay out a 1-3-6 month plan and the type of hires they need to build out their team to execute on that plan, I think that is a very concerning place to be in. The other thing I would add is with a senior person, you should be learning a lot in that conversation. Because when you hire a senior person, you know, they're not like the specialist, right? Like they're not the junior paid marketing specialist who's focused on like, you know, search engine marketing, but they are a specialist, right? You hire a head of sales or you hire a head of content or whatever, a head of product. They are a specialist relative to you, which means that if the head of product or the head of sales doesn't teach you something about sales and scaling a sales org or product and scaling a product org that you didn't know before, that's probably concerning as well. On the junior side, it's less about planning and it's more about mindset, I would say. It's more about, one, does this person have like the baseline IQ to be effective? And I would argue that like, you don't have to have that high of an IQ to be effective in a job, right? You don't have to be an absolute genius. I think the bar is lower than a lot of people think. The second thing I would have that I think is as important as IQ once you've hit that base level is mindset. Is this person curious? Does this person have grit? Is this person self-aware? Does this person have an openness to feedback? If you get a junior person who is gritty, who's self-aware of what they're good at and what they're not good at, who's curious and who's open to feedback, generally speaking, that is the formula for them to be really good at their job in a junior position.
Yeah, those are phenomenal insights. I appreciate that. And I think the interesting like double click on that I've asked a few founders and still I'm unclear on is like, let's say you're a senior person or like mid to senior level and you've done one thing your entire career, but you want to switch. It's tough for you to have had that, as you mentioned, because I completely agree. You want to have been there, done that, and have had a plan. But if you haven't had an opportunity in that type of vertical and you want to switch, do you think that person should take a step down and take like a more mid-level role at a different company or just try to find an earlier stage startup where they can, you know, be thrown in and try to learn?
I think it's a good question. I also think it's one of those things where some companies will take a risk on more senior people, a bigger risk than Austin and I would. I would say also it's all relative to scale, right? So if you're looking at a bigger company than Morning Brew, you could potentially get away with being in as senior of a position, even if it's not the exact experience, because if it's a bigger company, that means every single person, even if they're senior, potentially have less impact in the sense that they're not going to take down the whole business, right?
Whereas there's like overlaps everywhere.
Right, exactly. Not to say like big businesses are full of redundancies, but let's just say you were in, I don't know, a VP of marketing role at Pepsi, and you end up going to a VP of marketing role at, let's say, Vita Coco, the coconut water company. You have some relevant experience potentially. Say you were a VP of marketing at Pepsi and you were focused on mostly like retail distribution, right? So you have the experience of retail distribution for Vita Coco, but let's say part of this VP of marketing role, because Vita Coco is smaller, is both in like retail distribution, but also e-commerce distribution. Well, now you don't have relevant e-commerce distribution, but you have retail distribution. I don't think that necessarily is keeping you from getting hired at Vita Coco. If you are able to show how you laid out a clear plan, how you taught yourself how to understand and succeed in retail marketing and retail distribution, and how you plan to move up the curve really fast in e-commerce distribution and build a team around you of specialists that know that really well, I think you can get away with that. Because again, at Vita Coco, which I don't know how many employees they have, my guess is somewhere between 300 and 500, you're not going to take down the business on your own.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to look at it. That echoes similar to what a couple of other founders said. So I want to shift gears. I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about you guys, you know, selling a majority stake to Business Insider. So in October 2020, It was reported that you sold for $75 million. So first off, I want to say congrats on that. It's amazing.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
And so I think this is a super rare opportunity where, you know, you're super approachable and willing to share behind the scenes and have gone through this process. And so I know there's probably some things you can't talk about, but I would love for you to just break down, like, you know, you and Austin and leadership team in a room, how does this type of deal come together? And when you weigh the pros and cons to sell a majority stake at this moment, like, what does that look like?
Yeah, for sure. So it was a long process, for sure. It was the first time that, you know, obviously Austin and I have ever done a deal like this for you know, a number of months where we're kind of like in the thick of talking through the details of the deal. It really was like, you know, 50% to 100% of another full-time job. The relationship with Insider actually started way earlier than the deal talk started, which was, I want to say it was in 2018 when we were in our first office at the time, which was WeWork in the financial district of the city. It was kind of it all came out of this like scrappy growth mentality, where one of the ways we were trying to grow our audience was by doing cross promotions with other media companies. And we had reached out, I had connected with one of the editors at Business Insider, constantly asking him like, hey, is there a way to syndicate Morning Brew stories on BI's website? We could do a cross promotion. And I'd bugged him enough times because I was relentless. I bugged him enough times where he was just like, hey, I want to introduce you to so-and-so, basically just foisting me on someone else. And he introduced me to this guy, Claudius. Claudius, who's now the COO of Business Insider, but at the time, Claudius was running BI Prime, their subscription product. And Claudius and I met up for beers in the financial district on Stone Street, and we just talked about media. We just talked about like the history of BI, the history of Morning Brew, where media is going, etc. And we just hit it off, and there was literally no agenda other than networking, because in the early days of a business, like, building your network is so important. And we kept the relationship going. We played ping pong pretty regularly, where he would come to our WeWork space, play ping pong. We would go to Business Insider's space, play ping pong. And then, you know, the business continued to grow. He continued to keep an eye on our business. And then, you know, basically, let's call it beginning of 2020, around the beginning of 2020, we started having conversations that resembled, what if we worked together in a more meaningful way? And so it was a long process that took several months, and it all stemmed from that initial relationship, which for the first 2 years was nothing but just like a friendship and a relationship. And after, you know, let's call it, you know, 11 months of conversations around a deal that went from very active conversations to at times more of a lull, it just had this natural like flow to it, where at times it was very active, at other times it wasn't. Deal closed in October of last year. And the way that Austin and I thought about it was, we are at this inflection point in the business where we had this aspiration to expand Morning Brew from newsletter business to media brand, right? So from doing one thing about one type of content, right? Newsletters about business news, and go to a media brand that is newsletters, audio, video, social, website, events about business news, investing, personal finance, careers. And it was really exciting to us, but it was also really daunting to us, right? We had spent 4 years doing one thing. And so to us, the prospect of having a partner that was very startup founder friendly in Business Insider, because, you know, Henry Blodgett still runs the company, founded the company. He's like a hardcore entrepreneur at heart. Axel Springer, the company that owns Business Insider, has acquired hundreds of companies, has always put like the founder at the center of any of the work that they do. For us, the opportunity to work with a partner that was founder friendly, that had also gone through similar growth to us, right? Business Insider started as a newsletter and now has evolved into a, you know, multi-hundred-million-dollar company that does all of the things. To be able to learn from entrepreneurs who did it 10 years or 5 years before us was a really exciting thing. So it was balancing this with having a great partner who could provide us kind of this perspective and these resources so we didn't make all of the mistakes that would go into this transition of the business, while at the same time having a financial outcome that would allow us to take chips off the table and, you know, and have a life-changing amount of money that would give us a lot of optionality, you know, for the rest of our careers. Both of those were really exciting to us. And we continue to feel really confident about, you know, who we chose as a partner.
Yeah. It seems like the pieces fit pretty well together when you take a step back and look at what Business Insider has done and what you guys want to do. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And to that point also, I think that was something that BI saw in us was we filled gaps that they had in the world of newsletters. You know, of all the things they do really well, newsletters wasn't one of their superpowers and podcasting wasn't one of their superpowers. And those were kind of the two channels that have become superpowers within our business. And so I think they were really attracted to kind of the complementary assets that we had as a business.
Yeah, that's awesome. So I want to shift to the Startup Manifesto question, and then we'll shift to kind of a different section after that. But this is a question the show has become known for a little bit. And it basically is, if you were to write a Startup Manifesto with five of the most important key lessons or pitfalls to avoid when starting out building a company, what would they be?
The first is, I don't think there is a more important quality of a founder than being self-aware. I think self-awareness allows you to grow. Self-awareness allows you to understand or reveal your blind spots. And I think self-awareness has allowed Austin and I to be able to grow a company much larger than we probably should have been able to, because we knew what we knew and we had an openness to finding out what we didn't know and hiring around that. So that's the first. The second would be, people talk about, you know, everyone has strengths and weaknesses, right? And there's debate about, do you spend more time on your strengths? Do you strengthen your weaknesses? And I've gone back and forth on this because I think my way of being has always been, I'm competitive and I don't want to have weaknesses. I just want to have all strengths. And so I think my natural motive is to work on my weaknesses because that's a challenge. And if I can overcome that challenge, I feel the satisfaction of it. But I think really the right answer is, in building a business, doubling, tripling, quadrupling down on your strengths and then hiring into your weaknesses is probably the highest leverage, you know, best thing that you can do. So that's the second. The third is spending a lot of time thinking about how to hire properly. I think a lot of people, when they go to hire, shoot from the hip. They're not planned in their interviews. They get a job description up late. They, you know, they settle for good enough. And I think you realize once you start hiring that if you mishire and say 3 months, it takes you usually a month to realize that you made the wrong hire. It usually takes 3 to 6 months for you to actually let the person go. Once you realize that when you make a mishire, it set you back 9 months because you have to manage the person that you mishired. 6 months into it, that's when, you know, you separate. That's when you start a hiring process again for the new person. That usually a hiring process takes 2 months. You onboard someone, that takes another month. Like, hiring improperly is a 9-month setback. And so I would just say that I don't think you can put enough time or too much time into hiring really thoughtfully. That's the third. The fourth is having your non-negotiables in the work that you do. Like, to me, I've always had my non-negotiables in working at Morning Brew and in my career in general. And my non-negotiables are, I want to feel challenged. I want to work with great people. I want to build and provide something that adds value to a lot of people. I don't want to wake up in the morning feeling anxious, and I don't want to worry about money. And to me, as long as I'm doing those five things, I shouldn't do something else. Once five goes to four and four goes to three, that's when I have to really think hard about, are these reparable? Like, can these go back to all five criteria being satisfied? Or is there something that's changed permanently that needs to make me think more about what I'm doing with my time? The fifth is, as a founder, you have to evolve in the work that you do, right? So going back to the founder's journal I was talking about, right? In the early days, you're the writer, you're the editor, and you're the prompt creator, right? So like the prompt that we created for Morning Brew was, how can business news be better for our generation? The essay is Morning Brew. It is the daily newsletter, it is the product, the daily newsletter that is the best daily business read for millennials, bar none. In the early days, Austin and I wrote the prompt, which was the problem we want to solve. We created the product. We edited the product. And then you realize as the business grows, you start firing yourself from different positions, right? We fired ourselves from writing the essay. We hired great essay writers who wrote A-plus essays, not B-plus essays like we did. Then you start to hit your stride. You've hit product market fit. Your audience is getting bigger. You fire yourself again. Now you've hired writers and you've hired editors. So there's great writers creating a great product, and there's editors who are guiding and providing feedback to great writers. Now you're left just being the prompt creator, deciding what are the problems you want to continue solving. The work you do changes as you evolve as an entrepreneur. And I think what a lot of people fail to do is change their mindset as their work changes and how they attribute value to the work that they do. In the early days of building a business, the act of doing is addicting. Doing means equals productivity. The more you do, the more you feel productive. If by the time you get to the third stage of the business and you fired yourself from writing, you fired yourself from editing, and you're doing just like the prompt creation, well, prompt creation isn't a very productive feeling if you're still anchoring yourself to doing, right? Like, you are guiding the long-term strategy of where you want the business to go. You're not seeing the impact or fruits of that tomorrow, next week, or a month from now. You're seeing that like a year from now. And so I think something that I've struggled with, and a lot of entrepreneurs I believe do, is if you don't adjust your mentality for the way that you do your work changes, you're going to feel a level of dissatisfaction with the type of work you're doing as you have to change.
Yeah, man, that's a great list. We're going to clip that, and that's going to be pinned to the top of our promo. But
sweet.
Thanks for going through that.
Yeah.
All right, we've got a few minutes left, so I've got two last questions for you. We could spend a whole another hour on this first one, but it's kind of like simulating if you were starting from scratch today. So let's say Morning Brew's gone, the brand's gone, and but your knowledge is, your personal brand, let's say as a CEO, is gone, but your knowledge is still there.
Yep.
I want to talk about audience building, because you had an episode on this in Founders Journal, and you talked about this audience funnel that's really, really powerful. And so, you know, maybe take us through that, and like, where are you starting? Are you starting with newsletters? Are you starting with a different channel today? Like, what are you doing?
I think we started the hard way with newsletters, right? Because when you think about what is the easiest content for any person on planet Earth to find and share and consume, it is the content that lives on social, right? Like, it's the power of social media platforms, is that they connect billions of people, 5 billion people on the planet that have devices. The issue with creating content on social media is you don't own your audience. You rent your audience from social media platforms that dictate what your audience sees. And so you've seen a lot of media companies over the last 5 years get burned by this when they focused on creating massive audiences on Facebook or massive audiences on Instagram. And these platforms change their rules for what their audience is that they own, not you own, what those audience see. And all of a sudden, let's say hypothetically you had 1 million people who followed you. It went from one day 1 million people seeing your content to the next day 100,000 people seeing your content. like that dramatic of change has happened on the internet before. The value of email is that doesn't happen, right? You own your list, you own your emails. Someone has opted in, right? They've gone further than just clicking follow on Twitter or subscribe on YouTube. They've literally gone to your website, they've put in their email address. It is a way more active method of consuming content. And so the value of that is it has allowed us to build up an audience with Morning Brew that we have owned, and an audience that is very active because they have had to be the aggressor or on offense of deciding to consume our content. That all said, I actually think that I would start with content on these platforms to start if I was starting from scratch, because I think while it is a bad thing to only build audience on social media or social platforms, video platforms like Twitch or YouTube in the long term, because you open yourself up to platform risk that I was talking about, I think if you are thoughtful about building up audience on a platform, diversifying that audience by moving audience to other platforms, okay, you've diversified audience your risk a little bit, but then using that top of funnel to then funnel it into where you actually can own an audience, whether it's podcast, whether it's email, that would probably be my approach. Like, I think you can grow way faster if you build up a large audience leveraging the tools of social media and the connectivity of social media, build up an audience there in the short term, and then the intermediate term, convert as many of those people as you can to an owned audience. And I would choose email to this day.
Yeah, it's a fascinating question because I think that was the model Pomp used, right? He went hard with Twitter, built like 300,000 followers, and then went off. And like, I know you mentioned your friend Sahil's doing the same thing, Jack Butcher, they're ripping these Twitter audiences. And then, you know, I don't think Sahil's fully diversified yet, but he can at any moment. Versus I heard Sam Parr say from The Hustle, he wishes they started with that third piece that you didn't talk about yet, which was the monetized audience. He wishes they went full expensive subscription from day one. And it's just fascinating because I think you can win in all three ways. And it's just interesting depending on where you start.
Yeah, look, I think also the other thing you can do is you don't need the middle layer of an owned audience to be able to monetize an audience. While I do think it's riskier, there have been examples of people who build huge Twitter audiences or huge YouTube audiences, launch a paid product, and take people from social platform to paid product. Like David Perel is a great example of that. Built up a big audience on Twitter and then converted it to his writing course. Now he's built up an email list, but that has only come recently.
Yeah, I love that. All right, last thing before we let you go. So this is kind of like the brainstorm section, but you know, either in media or outside, where is there white space that's interesting to you right now? What are some ideas that you wish existed, or products you wish existed, or businesses that if you weren't in media, you would think about starting?
Yeah, I mean, for me, the two are business education and mental health. To me, there is so much. I fundamentally believe that every person on planet Earth should have someone that is kind of, let's call it like their emotional Sherpa in life. And I think that can take the form of a therapist, that can take the form of a career coach or an executive coach, that could take the form of a peer group. And I think, I don't know what the percentage of people on planet Earth are that have their version of emotional Sherpa, but what I do fundamentally believe is that because kind of that tool has been stigmatized for so long, the percentage of people on planet Earth that are going to have it 10 years from now versus today is going to be significantly larger. And so I think there's opportunity to latch onto that tailwind. And it's something I'm just personally very passionate about. As someone who's, you know, worked with a therapist for 8 years, who's thought about, you know, working with an executive coach, I just find it immensely helpful. And it's actually crazy to me to think about if I didn't have a therapist, what I would be doing. It's like the equivalent of like, you know, I use my Peloton or I go to the gym to work out physically. The fact that people don't have tools to work out mentally is mind-blowing to me. So that's one. The second is business education. You know, as much as I loved my college experience, I think I loved my college experience for everything other than the classes that I took. And I think there's an opportunity to connect like the real world insights that people have on the job with traditional learning, because I just think fundamentally what is taught in school is not what you learn or are what you need to know in your career. And we see a lot of examples of people trying to break this system, but it's, I don't think it's going to be a one person takes all market. And I think there's a ton of opportunity to flip business education on its head.
Yeah, I totally agree with both of those. I think to the latter point, schools and practice are completely disconnected. It makes no sense. And I think a few people have attempted to solve this, and there hasn't been a great solve for it yet. To the first point, and usually like we riff back and forth, but now you got to go. To the first point, have you heard of Future?
I have not.
You should check it out. So I think you're pretty into fitness just from looking at your content. Yeah. And we had the founder Rishi on here a few episodes ago. So basically they do one-on-one remote personal training for fitness. But what they basically unearthed was, what do like A-list celebrities and business executives and pro athletes have in common with fitness? Why are they able to continue? Is because they outsource it to a coach. And so what Rishi realized is, you know, and I think mental health, there's a corollary here. We've given people the tools like Calm and Headspace and these apps. They don't really do it. We've given people content, blogs, and endless YouTube videos. Yep. They don't really do it. The thing they're missing is that coaching.
Yeah, so accountability. If there was a way,
yeah, exactly. If there was a way to provide that coach for a price people could afford, I love that too.
I love that. Yeah, I'll check out Future after this.
Awesome. All right, man. Before I let you go, I just want to acknowledge you real quick. Thank you so much for coming on. I think I love what you're doing with Founders Journal. Obviously, Morning Brew has been a huge success, and I appreciate it and salute you.
Thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Alex Lieberman, co-founder and CEO of Morning Brew. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for listening to that episode with Alex Lieberman of Morning Brew. If you're loving the show and want to support, there's a couple ways you can help. First, the most important thing you can do is just share the show, tweet about what you learned, or just text the link to a friend who you think would like it. Second, every week, I also send out a 5-minute email recap of the episode on Substack. If you're busy and can't listen to the whole episode each week, that's totally fine. All you have to do is subscribe to our list, and the recaps will be delivered to you every single week. Go to thefounder.substack.com to sign up. Lastly, we also have a website that serves as a hub for the show. On it, we have a page called Special Offers, where we link up the discount codes from our guests. If you're thinking about buying any of the products or services we chat about on the show, I highly recommend you check it out and take advantage of the free money. Our site is thefounderpod.com. I hope you enjoyed that episode and are looking forward to the next one. Until then, I'm Callaway, and this is The Founder.